center to try and blunt the threat. If he should fall in the fight that must follow, the wall would be safe for another 100 years, John judged. And if not... He flexed the burnt fingers of his sword hand. Longclaw was slung to his saddle. The carved stone wolf's head pommel and soft leather grip of the great bastard sword within easy reach. The snow was falling heavily by the time they caught Tormund's band, several hours later. Ghost departed along the way, melting into the forest at the scent of prey. The direwolf would return when they made camp for the night, by dawn at the latest. However far he prowled, Ghost always came back. And so, it seemed, did Ygritte.
"So," the girl called when she saw him, "do you believe us now, Jon Snow? Did you see the giants on their mammoths?"
"Ha!" shouted Tormund before Jon could reply. "The crow's in love. He means to marry one."
"A giantess?"
Longspear Rick laughed.
"No! A mammoth!"
Tormund bellowed.
"Ha! Ha! Ha!"
Ygritte trotted beside Jon as he slowed his garron to a walk. She claimed to be 3 years older than him, though she stood half a foot shorter. However old she might be, the girl was a tough little thing. Stone Snake had called her a spear wife when they'd captured her in the Skirling Pass. She wasn't wed, and her weapon of choice was a short curved bow of horn and weirwood, but spear wife fit her all the same. She reminded him a little of his sister, Arya, though Arya was younger and probably skinnier. It was hard to tell how plump or thin Ygritte might be with all the furs and skin she wore.
"Do you know the last of the giants?"
Without waiting for an answer, Ygritte said, "You need a deeper voice than mine to do it proper." Then she sang, "Oh, I am the last of the giants. My people are gone from the earth." Tormund Giantsbane heard the words and grinned.
"The last of the great mountain giants who ruled all the world at my birth," he bellowed back through the snow.
Longspear Rick joined in, singing,
"Oh, the small folk have stolen my forest. They've stolen my rivers and hills."
"And they've built a great wall through my valleys, and fished all the fish from my rills."
Ygritte and Tormund sang back at him in turn, in suitable, gigantic voices. Tormund's sons, Toreg and Dormund, added their deep voices as well. Then his daughter Munda and all the rest. Others began to bang their spears on leathern shields to keep rough time, until the whole war band was singing as they rode.
"In stone halls they burn their great fires, in stone halls they forge their sharp spears. When I walk alone in the mountains, with no true companions but tears, oh, they hunt me with dogs in the daylight, they hunt me with torches at night. For these men who are small can never stand tall, while giants still walk in the light. Oh, I am the last of the giants, so learn well the words of my song. For when I am gone, the singing will fade, and the silence shall last long and long."
There were tears on Ygritte's cheeks when the song ended. "Why are you weeping?" John asked. "It was only a song. There are hundreds of giants. I've just seen them."
"Oh, hundreds," she said furiously. "You know nothing, Jon Snow. You... Jon..."
Jon turned at the sudden sound of wings. Blue-gray feathers filled his eyes as sharp talons buried themselves in his face. Red pain lanced through him sudden and fierce as pinions beat around his head. He saw the beak, but there was no time to get a hand up or reach for a weapon. John reeled backward. His foot lost the stirrup. His garron broke in panic, and then he was falling, and still the eagle clung to his face, its talons tearing at him as it flapped and shrieked and pecked. The world turned upside down in a chaos of feathers and horseflesh and blood, and then the ground came up to smash him. The next he knew, he was on his face, with the taste of mud and blood in his mouth, and Egret kneeling over him protectively, a bone dagger in her hand. He could still hear wings, though the eagle was not in sight. Half his world was black. "My eye!" he said in sudden panic, raising a hand to his face. "It's only blood, Jon Snow. He missed the eye. Just ripped your skin up some." His face was throbbing. Tormund stood over them, bellowing, he saw from his right eye, as he rubbed blood from his left. Then there were hoofbeats, shouts, and the clacking of old dry bones. "Bag of bones!" roared Tormund. "Call off your Elcrow!" "There's your Elcrow," Rattleshirt pointed at John, "bleeding in the mud, like a faithless dog." The eagle came flapping down to land atop the broken giant's skull that served him for his helm. "I'm here for him."
"Come, take him then," said Tormund, "but best come with sword in hand, for that's where you'll find mine. Might be I'll boil your bones and use your skull to piss in. Ha! Once I prick you and let the air out, you'll shrink down smaller than that girl. Stand aside, or Mance will hear of this."
Egret stood. "What, is it Mance who wants him?"
"I said so, didn't I? Get him up on those black feet."
Tormund frowned down at John.
"Best go, if it's a Mance who's wanting you."
Egret helped pull him up.
"He's bleeding like a butchered boar. Look what Aurel did to his sweet face."
"Can a bird hate?" John had slain the wildling, Aurel, but some part of the man remained within the eagle. The golden eyes looked out on him with cold malevolence. "I'll come," he said. The blood kept running down into his right eye, and his cheek was a blaze of pain. When he touched it, his black gloves came away stained with red. "Let me catch my Garen." It was not the horse he wanted so much as Ghost, but the dire wolf was nowhere to be seen. He could be leagues away by now, ripping out the throat of some elk. Perhaps that was just as well. The Garen shied away from him when he approached, no doubt frightened by the blood on his face, but John calmed him with a few quiet words and finally got close enough to take the reins. As he swung back into the saddle, his head whirled. "I will need to get this tended," he thought, "but not just now. Let the king beyond the wall see what his eagle did to me." His right hand opened and closed, and he reached down for Longclaw and slung the bastard sword over a shoulder before he wheeled to trot back to where the Lord of Bones and his band were waiting. Egret was waiting too, sitting on her horse with a fierce look on her face.
"I am coming too." "Be gone!"
The bones of Rattleshirt's breastplate clattered together.
"I was sent for the Crow Come Down, none other."
"A free woman rides where she will," Egret said.
The wind was blowing snow into John's eyes. He could feel the blood freezing on his face. "Are we talking or riding?"
"Riding," said the Lord of Bones.
It was a grim gallop. They rode 2 miles down the column, through swirling snows, then cut through a tangle of baggage wains to splash across the milk water, where it took a great loop towards the east. A crust of thin ice covered the river shallows. With every step their horses' hooves crashed through, until they reached the deeper water 10 yards out. The snow seemed to be falling even faster on the eastern bank, and the drifts were deeper too. Even the wind is colder. And night was falling too. But even through the blowing snow, the shape of the great white hill that loomed above the trees was unmistakable. The Fist of the First Men. John heard the scream of the eagle overhead. A raven looked down from a soldier pine and quacked as he went past. Had the old bear made his attack? Instead of the clash of steel and the thrum of arrows taking flight, John heard only the soft crunch of frozen crust beneath his Garen's hooves. In silence, they circled round to the south slope, where the approach was easiest. It was there at the bottom that John saw the dead horse, sprawled at the base of the hill, half buried in the snow. Entrails spilled from the belly of the animal like frozen snakes, and one of its legs was gone. Wolves, was John's first thought, but that was wrong. Wolves eat their kill. More garrons were strewn across the slope, legs twisted grotesquely, blind eyes staring in death. The wildlings crawled over them like flies, stripping them of saddles, bridles, packs and armor, and hacking them apart with stone axes.
Up! Rattleshirt told John. Mance is up top!
Outside the ring wall they dismounted to squeeze through a crooked gap in the stones. The carcass of a shaggy brown garron was impaled upon the sharpened stakes the old bear had placed inside every entrance. He was trying to get out, not in. There was no sign of a rider. Inside was more and worse. John had never seen pink snow before. The wind gusted around him, pulling at his heavy sheepskin cloak. Ravens flapped from one dead horse to the next. Are those wild ravens, or our own? John could not tell. He wondered where poor Sam was now, and what he was. A crust of frozen blood crunched beneath the heel of his boot. The wildlings were stripping the dead horses of every scrap of steel and leather, even prying the horseshoes off their hooves. A few were going through packs they'd turned up, looking for weapons and food. John passed one of Chet's dogs, or what remained of him, lying in a sludgy pool of half-frozen blood. A few tents were still standing at the far side of the camp, and it was there they found Mance Rayder. Beneath his slash cloak of black wool and red silk, he wore black ring mail and shaggy fur breeches, and on his head was a great bronze and iron helm with raven wings at either temple. Jarl was with him, and Harma the dog's head, Stir as well, and Varamir Sixskins with his wolves and his shadow cat. The look Mance gave John was grim and cold.
"What happened to your face?"
Ygritte said, "Aurel tried to take his eye out."
"It was him," I asked. "Has he lost his tongue? Perhaps he should, to spare us further lies."
Stir the Magnar drew a long knife.
"The boy might see more clear with one eye instead of two."
"Would you like to keep your eye, John?" asked the king beyond the wall. "If so, tell me how many they were. And try and speak the truth this time, bastard of Winterfell."
John's throat was dry.
"My lord, what—"
"I am not your lord," said Mance. "And the what is plain enough. Your brothers died. The question is, how many?"
John's face was throbbing. The snow kept coming down, and it was hard to think. "You must not balk, whatever is asked of you," Corrin had told him. The words stuck in his throat, but he made himself say, "There were 300 of us."
"Us?"
Man said sharply. "Them. 300 of them." "Whatever is asked," the half-hand said. "So why do I feel so craven?" 200 from Castle Black, and 100 from the Shadow Tower."
"There's a truer song than the one you sang in my tent."
Mance looked to Harma Dog's head.
"How many horses have we found?"
"More'n 100, the huge woman replied. "Less than 2. There's more dead to the east, under the snow. Hard to know how many."
Behind her stood her banner-bearer, holding a pole with a dog's head on it, fresh enough to still be leaking blood.
"You should never have lied to me, John Snow," said Mance.
I know that." What could he say? The wildling king studied his face.
"Who had the command here? And tell me true. Was it Riker? Smallwood? Not Withers, he's too feeble. Whose tent was this?"
"I have said too much." "You did not find his body?" Harmer snorted, her disdain thrusting from her nostrils.
What fools these black crows be!
The next time you answer me with a question, I will give you to my Lord of Bones,
Mansraider promised John.
He stepped closer. Who led here?
One more step, thought John. Another foot. He moved his hand closer to Longclaw's hilt. If I hold my tongue...
Reach up for that bastard sword, and I'll have your bastard head off before it clears the scabbard, said Mance. I'm fast losing patience with you, crow.
Say it, Ygritte urged. He's dead, whoever he was.
His frown cracked the blood on his cheek. This is too hard, John thought in despair. How do I play the turn cloak without becoming one? Corrin had not told him that. But the second step is always easier than the first. The old bear.
That old man?
Harmer's tone said she did not believe it.
He came himself? Then who commands at Castle Black?
Bowen Marsh. This time John answered at once. You must not balk whatever is asked of you. Mance laughed.
If so, our war is won. Bowen knows a deal more about counting swords than he's ever known about using them.
The old bear commanded, said John. This place was high and strong, and he made it stronger. He dug pits and planted stakes, laid up food and water. He was ready for...
Me?
Finished Mance Raider.
Aye, he was. Had I been fool enough to storm this hill, I might have lost 5 men for every crow I slew, and still counted myself lucky.
His mouth grew hard.
But when the dead walk, walls and stakes and swords mean nothing. You cannot fight the dead, Jon Snow. No man knows that half so well as me.
He gazed up at the darkening sky and said,
The crows may have helped us more than they know. I'd wondered why we'd suffered no attacks. But there's still 100 leagues to go, and the cold is rising. Verimir, send your wolf sniffing after the whites. I won't have them taking us unawares. My Lord of Bones, double all the patrols, and make certain every man has torch and flint. Stir, Jarl, you ride at first light.
Mance, Rattleshirt said, I want me some crow bones.
Ygritte stepped in front of John.
You can't kill a man for laying to protect them as was his brothers.
They are still his brothers, declared Stir.
They're not,
insisted Ygritte.
He never killed me, like they told him, and he slew the half-hand we all saw.
John's breath misted the air. If I lie to him, he'll know. He looked Mance Raider in the eyes, opened and closed his burned hand. I wear the cloak you gave me, Your Grace.
A sheepskin cloak, said Ygritte, and there's many a night we danced beneath it, too.
Jarl laughed, and even Harmer Dogshead smirked.
Is that the way of it, Jon Snow?
Asked Mance Raider mildly.
Her and you.
It was easy to lose your way beyond the wall. John did not know that he could tell honour from shame any more, or right from wrong. Father, forgive me. Yes, he said. Mance nodded.
Good. You'll go with Jarl and Stirl and the morrow, then, both of you. Far be it from me to separate 2 hearts that beat as one.
Go where? Asked John.
Over the wall. It's past time you proved your faith with something more than words, Jon Snow.
The Magna was not pleased.
What do I want with a crow?
He knows the watch, and he knows the wall, said Mance, and he knows Castle Black better than any raider ever could. You'll find a use for him, or you're a fool.
Stir scowled. His heart may still be black.
Then cut it out.
Mance turned to Rattleshirt.
My Lord of Bones, keep the column moving at all costs. If we reach the wall before Mormont, we've won.
They'll move.
Rattleshirt's voice was thick and angry. Mance nodded and walked away, Palmer and six skins beside him. Varamere's wolves and Shadowcat followed behind. John and Ygritte were left with Jarl, Rattleshirt, and the Magna. The two older wildlings looked at John with ill-concealed rancor as Jarl said,
"You heard. We ride at daybreak. Bring all the food you can. There'll be no time to hunt. And have your face seen to, Crow. You look a bloody mess."
"I will," said John.
"You'd best not be lying, girl,"
Rattleshirt said to Ygritte, his eyes shining behind the giant skull. John drew Longclaw. "Get away from us, unless you want what Corrin got."
"You got no wolf to help you here, boy."
Rattleshirt reached for his own sword.
"Sure of that, are ya?"
Ygritte laughed. Atop the stones of the ring wall, Ghost hunched with white fur bristling. He made no sound, but his dark red eyes spoke blood. The Lord of Bones moved his hand slowly away from his sword, backed off a step, and left them with a curse. Ghost padded beside their garrons as John and Ygritte descended the fist. It was not until they were halfway across the milk water that John felt safe enough to say, "I never asked you to lie for me."
"I never did," she said. "I left out part, is all. You said that we fuck beneath your cloak many a night. I never said when we started, though."
The smile she gave him was almost shy.
"Find another place for ghosts to sleep tonight, Jon Snow. It's like Mance said, deeds is truer than words."
Sansa. "A new gown?" she said, as wary as she was astonished.
"More lovely than any you've worn, my lady,"
the old woman promised. She measured Sansa's hips with a length of knotted string.
"All silk and Moorish lace with satin linings. You will be very beautiful. The queen herself has commanded it."
Which queen? Marjorie was not yet Joff's queen, but she had been Renly's. Or did she mean the Queen of Thorns, or...
"The Queen Regent, to be sure."
"Queen Cersei?"
"None other. She has honored me with her custom for many a year."
The old woman laid her string along the inside of Sansa's leg.
"Her Grace said to me that you are a woman now, and should not dress like a little girl. Hold out your arm."
Sansa lifted her arm. She needed a new gown, that was true. She had grown 3 inches in the past year, and most of her own wardrobe had been ruined by the smoke when she'd tried to burn her mattress on the day of her first flowering.
"Your bosom will be as lovely as the Queen's,"
the old woman said, as she looped her string around Sansa's chest.
"You should not hide it so."
The comment made her blush. Yet the last time she'd gone riding, she could not lace her jerkin all the way to the top, and the stable boy gaped at her as he helped her mount. Sometimes she caught grown men looking at her chest as well, and some of her tunics were so tight she could scarce breathe in them. "What color will it be?" she asked the seamstress.
"Leave the colors to me, my lady. You will be pleased, I know you will. You shall have small clothes and hose as well, kirtles and mantles and cloaks, and all else befitting a lovely young lady of noble birth."
"Will they be ready in time for the king's wedding?"
"Oh, sooner, much sooner. Her Grace insists. I have 6 seamstresses and 12 apprentice girls, and we have set all other work aside for this. Many ladies will be cross with us, but it was the Queen's command."
"Thank Her Grace kindly for her thoughtfulness," Sansa said politely. "She is too good to me."
"Her Grace is most generous,"
the seamstress agreed, as she gathered up her things and took her leave. But why, Sansa wondered when she was alone. It made her uneasy. "I'll wager this gown is Marjorie's doing somehow, or her grandmother's." Marjorie's kindness had been unfailing, and her presence changed everything. Her ladies welcomed Sansa as well. It had been so long since she had enjoyed the company of other women, she had almost forgotten how pleasant it could be. Lady Leonette gave her lessons on the high harp, and Lady Jana shared all the choice gossip. Mary Crane always had an amusing story, and little Lady Bulwer reminded her of Arya, though not so fierce. Closest to Sansa's own age were the cousins Eleanor, Arla, and Megha, Tyrells from junior branches of the house. "Roses from lower on the bush," quipped Eleanor, who was witty and willowy. Megha was round and loud, Arla shy and pretty. But Eleanor ruled the three by right of womanhood. She was a maiden flowered, whereas Megha and Arla were mere girls. The cousins took Sansa into their company as if they had known her all their lives. They spent long afternoons doing needlework and talking over lemon cakes and honeyed wine, played at tiles of an evening, sang together in the castle sept, and often one or two of them would be chosen to share Margaery's bed, where they would whisper half the night away. Arla had a lovely voice, and when coaxed would play the wood harp and sing songs of chivalry and lost loves. Megha couldn't sing, but she was mad to be kissed. She and Arla played a kissing game sometimes, she confessed, but it wasn't the same as kissing man, much less a king. Sansa wondered what Megha would think about kissing the hound, as she had. He'd come to her the night of the battle, stinking of wine and blood. He kissed me, and threatened to kill me, and made me sing him a song. "King Joffrey has such beautiful lips," Megha gushed, oblivious. "Oh, poor Sansa, how your heart must have broken when you lost him. Oh, how you must have wept."
"Joffrey made me weep more often than you know," she wanted to say. But Butterbumps was not at hand to drown out her voice, so she pressed her lips together and held her tongue. As for Eleanor, she was promised to a young squire, a son of Lord Ambrose. They would be wed as soon as he won his spurs. He had won her favour in the Battle of the Blackwater, where he'd slain a Moorish crossbowman and a Mullendore man-at-arms.
"Alan said her favour made him fearless," said Megha. "He says he shouted her name for his battle-cry. Isn't that ever so gallant? Some day I want some champion to wear my favour and kill 100 men.
Eleanor told her to hush, but looked pleased all the same. "They are children," Sansa thought. "They are silly little girls, even Eleanor. They've never seen a battle. They've never seen a man die. They know nothing. Their dreams were full of songs and stories, the way hers had been before Joffrey cut her father's head off. Sansa pitied them. Sansa envied them. Margaery was different, though. Sweet and gentle, yet there was a little of her grandmother in her, too. The day before last, she'd taken Sansa hawking. It was the first time she'd been outside the city since the battle. The dead had been burned or buried, but the mudgate was scarred and splintered, where Lord Stannis's rams had battered it, and the hulls of smashed ships could be seen along both sides of the Blackwater, charred masts poking from the shallows like gaunt black fingers. The only traffic was the flat-bottom ferry that took them across the river, and when they reached the Kingswood, they found a wilderness of ash and charcoal and dead trees. But the waterfowl teemed in the marshes along the bay, and Sansa's Merlin brought down 3 ducks while Margaery's Peregrine took a heron in full flight. "Willis has the best birds in the 7 kingdoms," Margaery said when the two of them were briefly alone. "He flies an eagle sometimes. You will see, Sansa." She took her by the hand and gave it a squeeze. "Sister?"
Sister?
Sansa had once dreamt of having a sister like Margaery, beautiful and gentle, with all the world's graces at her command. Arya had been entirely unsatisfactory as sisters went.
"How can I let my sister marry Joffrey?" she thought.
And suddenly her eyes were full of tears.
"Margaery, please," she said, "you mustn't."
It was hard to get the words out.
You mustn't marry him.
He's not like he seems. He's not. He'll hurt you.
I shouldn't think so. Marjorie smiled confidently. It's brave of you to warn me, but you need not fear. Joffrey's spoiled and vain, and I don't doubt that he's cruel, as you say, but father forced him to name Loras to his king's guard before he would agree to the match. I shall have the finest knight in the Seven Kingdoms protecting me night and day, as Prince Aemon protected Nerys. So our little lion had best behave, hadn't it? She laughed and said, "Come, sweet sister, let's race back to the river. It will drive our guards quite mad." And without waiting for an answer, she put her heels into a horse and flew.
She is so brave, Sansa thought, galloping after her, and yet her doubts still gnawed at her. Sir Loras was a great knight, all agreed, but Joffrey had other king's guard, and gold cloaks, and red cloaks besides, and when he was older he would command armies of his own. Aegon the Unworthy had never harmed Queen Nerys, perhaps for fear of their brother, the Dragon Knight. But when another of his king's guards fell in love with one of his mistresses, the king had taken both their heads. "Sir Loras is a Tyrell," Sansa reminded herself. "That other knight was only a Toyn. His brothers had no armies, no way to avenge him but with swords." Yet the more she thought about it all, the more she wondered. Joff might restrain himself for a few turns, perhaps as long as a year, but soon or late he will show his claws, and when he does, the realm might have a second Kingslayer, and there would be war inside the city, as the men of the Lion and the men of the Rose made the gutters run red. Sansa was surprised that Marjorie did not see it too. "She is older than me. She must be wiser. And her father, Lord Tyrell, he knows what he's doing, surely. I am just being silly." When she told Sir Dontus that she was going to Highgarden to marry Willis Tyrell, she thought he would be relieved and pleased for her. Instead, he had grabbed her arm and said, "You cannot," in a voice as thick with horror as with wine. "I tell you, these Tyrells are only Lannisters with flowers. I beg of you, forget this folly. Give your Florian a kiss, and promise you'll go ahead as we have planned. The night of Joffrey's wedding, that's not so long, wear the silver hairnet and do as I told you, and afterwards we'll make our escape." He tried to plant a kiss on her cheek. Sansa slipped from his grasp and stepped away from him. "I won't. I can't. Something would go wrong. When I wanted to escape, you wouldn't take me, and now I don't need to." Donta stared at her stupidly. "But the arrangements are made, sweetling. The ship to take you home. The boat to take you to the ship. Your Florian did it all for his sweet Junkle." "I'm sorry for all the trouble I put you to," she said, "but I have no need of boats and ships now."
"But it's all to see you safe."
"I will be safe in Highgarden. Willis will keep me safe."
"But he does not know you,"
Dantos insisted.
"And he will not love you. Junkle, Junkle, open your sweet eyes. These Tyrells care nothing for you. It's your claim they mean to wed."
"My claim?" She was lost for a moment.
"Sweetling," he told her, "you are heir to Winterfell."
He grabbed her again, pleading that she must not do this thing, and Sansa wrenched free and left him swaying beneath the heart tree. She had not visited the Guardswood since. But she had not forgotten his words either. The heir to Winterfell, she would think, as she lay abed at night. "It's your claim they mean to wed." Sansa had grown up with three brothers. She never thought to have a claim. But with Bran and Rickon dead, it doesn't matter. There's still Rob. He's a man grown now, and soon he'll wed and have a son. Anyway, Willis Tyrell will have Highgarden. What would he want with Winterfell? Sometimes she would whisper his name into her pillow just to hear the sound of it. Willis, Willis. Willis.
Willis was as good a name as Loris, she supposed. They even sounded the same. A little. What did it matter about his leg? Willis would be Lord of Highgarden, and she would be his lady. She pictured the two of them sitting together in a garden with puppies in their laps, or listening to a singer strum upon a lute while they floated down the Mander on a pleasure barge. If I give him sons, he may come to love me. She would name them Edard and Brandon and Rickon, and raise them all to be as valiant as Sir Loras, and to hate Lannisters too. In Sansa's dreams, her children looked just like the brothers she had lost. Sometimes there was even a girl who looked like Arya. She could never hold the picture of Willis long in her head, though. Her imaginings kept turning him back into Sir Loras, young and graceful and beautiful. "You must not think of him like that," she told herself, "or else he may see the disappointment in your eyes when you meet. And how could he marry you then, knowing it was his brother you loved?" Willis Tyrell was twice her age, she reminded herself constantly, and lame as well, and perhaps even plump and red-faced like his father. But calmly or no, he might be the only champion she would ever have. Once she dreamed it was still her marrying Joff, not Margaery, and on their wedding night he turned into the headsman, Ilion Payne. She woke trembling. She did not want Margaery to suffer as she had, but she dreaded the thought that the Tyrells might refuse to go ahead with the wedding. "I warned her, I did, I told her the truth of him." Perhaps Margaery did not believe her. Joff always played the perfect knight with her, as once he had with Sansa. She will see his true nature soon enough, after the wedding, if not before. Sansa decided that she would light a candle to the Mother Above the next time she visited the Sept, and ask her to protect Margaery from Joffrey's cruelty, and perhaps a candle to the warrior as well, for Loras. She would wear her new gown for the ceremony at the Great Sept of Baelor, she decided, as the seamstress took her last measurement. "That must be why Cersei is having it made for me, so I will not look shabby at the wedding." She really ought to have a different gown for the feast afterward, but she supposed one of her old ones would do. She did not want to risk getting food or wine on the new one. "I must take it with me to Highgarden." She wanted to look beautiful for Willis Tyrell, even if Dantos was right. "And it is Winterfell he wants, and not me. He still may come to love me for myself." Sansa hugged herself tightly, wondering how long it would be before the gown was ready. She could scarcely wait to wear it. Arya. The rains came and went, but there was more grey sky than blue, and all the streams were running high. On the morning of the third day, Arya noticed that the moss was growing mostly on the wrong side of the trees. "We're going the wrong way," she said to Gendry, as they rode past an especially mossy elm. "We're going south. See how the moss is growing on the trunk?" He pushed thick black hair from his eyes and said, "We're following the road, that's all. The road goes south here." "We've been going south all day," she wanted to tell him, "and yesterday too, when we were riding along that stream bed." But she hadn't been paying close attention yesterday, so she couldn't be certain. "I think we're lost," she said in a low voice. "We shouldn't have left the river. All we had to do was follow it." "The river bends and loops," said Gendry. "This is just a shorter way, I bet. Some secret outlaw way. Lem and Tom and them have been living here for years." That was true. Arya bit her lip. "But the moss. The way it's raining, we'll have moss growing from our ears before long," Gendry complained. "Only from our south ear," Arya declared stubbornly. There was no use trying to convince the bull of anything. Still, he was the only true friend she had, now that Hot Pie had left them.
"Shana says she needs me to bake bread," he told her the day they rode. "Anyhow, I'm tired of rain and saddle sores and being scared all the time. There's ale here, and rabbit cake, and the bread will be better when I make it. You'll see when you come back. You will come back, won't you, when the war's done?
He remembered who she was then and added,
My lady,
reddening. Arya didn't know if the war would ever be done, but she had nodded. I'm sorry I beat you that time, she said. Hot Pie was stupid and craven, but he'd been with her all the way from King's Landing, and she'd gotten used to him. I broke your nose.
You broke Lem's too, Hot Pie grinned. That was good.
Lem didn't think so, Arya said glumly. Then it was time to go. When Hot Pie asked if he might kiss Milady's hand, she punched his shoulder.
Don't call me that. You're Hot Pie, and I'm Harry. I'm not Hot Pie here. Shanna just calls me Boy, the same as she calls the other Boy. It's going to be confusing.
She missed him more than she thought she would, but Harwin made up for it some. She had told him about his father, Hullan, and how she'd found him dying by the stables in the Red Keep the day she fled. He always said he'd die in a stable, Harwin said, but we all thought some bad-tempered stallion would be his death, not a pack of lions. Arya told of Yoren and their escape from King's Landing as well, and much that had happened since. But she left out the stable boy she'd stabbed with needle, and the guard whose throat she'd cut to get out of Harrenhal. Telling Harwin would be almost like telling her father, and there were some things she could not bear having her father know. Nor did she speak of Jake and Hagar, and the three deaths he'd owed and paid. The iron coin he'd given her Arya kept tucked away beneath her belt, but sometimes at night she would take it out and remember how his face had melted and changed when he ran his hand across it. Velar Morghulis, she would say under her breath. Sir Gregor, Dunson, Polliver, Raff the Sweetling, the Tickler and the Hound, Sir Ilion, Sir Merin, Queen Cersei, King Joffrey. Only 6 Winterfell men remained of the 20 her father had sent west with Beric Dondarrion, Harwin told her, and they were scattered. It was a trap, milady. Lord Tywin sent his mountain across the Red Fork with fire and sword, hoping to draw your lord father. He planned for Lord Eddard to come west himself to deal with Gregor Clegane. If he had, he would have been killed or taken prisoner and traded for the imp, who was your mother's captive at the time. Only the Kingslayer never knew Lord Tywin's plan, and when he heard about his brother's capture, he attacked your father in the streets of King's Landing. I remember, said Arya, he killed Jory. Jory had always smiled at her when he wasn't telling her to get from underfoot. He killed Jory, Harwin agreed, and your father's leg was broken when his horse fell on him. So Lord Eddard couldn't go west. He sent Lord Beric instead with 20 of his own men and 20 from Winterfell, me among them. There were others besides, Thoros and Sir Raymond Darry and their men, Sir Gladden Wild, a lord named Lothar Mallory. But Gregor was waiting for us at the Mummer's Ford with men concealed on both banks. As we crossed, he fell upon us from front and rear. I saw the mountain slay Raymond Darry with a single blow. So terrible, it took Darry's arm off at the elbow and killed the horse beneath him, too. Gladden Wild died there with him, and Lord Mallory was ridden down and drowned. We had lions on every side, and I thought I was doomed with the rest. But Alan shouted commands and restored order to our ranks, and those still a horse rallied around Thoros and cut our way free. 60 we'd been that morning. By dark, no more than 20 were left, and Lord Beric was gravely wounded. Thoros drew a foot of lance from his chest that night and poured boiling wine into the hole it left. Every man of us was certain his lordship would be dead by daybreak, but Thoros prayed with him all night beside the fire, and when dawn came he was still alive, and stronger than he had been. It was a fortnight before he could mount a horse, but his courage kept us strong. He told us that our war had not ended at the Mummer's Ford, but only begun there, and that every man of ours who'd fallen would be avenged tenfold. By then the fighting had passed by us. The mountain's men were only the van of Lord Tywin's host. They crossed the Red Fork in strength and swept up into the riverlands, burning everything in their path. We were so few that all we could do was harry their rear. But we told each other that we'd join up with King Robert when he marched west to crush Lord Tywin's rebellion. Only then we heard that Robert was dead, and Lord Eddard as well, and Cersei Lannister's whelp had ascended the Iron Throne. That turned the whole world on its head. We'd been sent out by the King's Hand to deal with outlaws, you see, but now we were the outlaws, and Lord Tywin was the hand of the King. There were some wanted to yield then, but Lord Beric wouldn't hear of it. We were still King's men, he said, and these were the King's people the lions were savaging. If we could not fight for Robert, we would fight for them, until every man of us was dead. And so we did. But as we fought, something queer happened. For every man we lost, two showed up to take his place. A few were knights or squires of gentle birth, but most were common men, field hands and fiddlers and innkeepers, servants and shoemakers, even two septons, men of all sorts, and women too, children, dogs.
Dogs? Said Arya.
Aye, Harwin grinned. One of our lads keeps the meanest dogs you'd ever want to see.
I wish I had a good mean dog, said Arya wistfully. A lion-killing dog. She'd had a direwolf once, Nymeria, but she'd thrown rocks at her until she fled, to keep the queen from killing her. Could a direwolf kill a lion? She wondered. It rained again that afternoon, and long into the evening. Thankfully, the outlaws had secret friends all over, so they did not need to camp out in the open, or seek shelter beneath some leaky bower, as she and Hutpie and Gendry had done so often. That night they sheltered in a burned, abandoned village. At least it seemed to be abandoned, until Jack Bilucky blew two short blasts and two long ones on his hunting horn. Then all sorts of people came crawling out of the ruins and up from secret cellars. They had ale and dried apples and some stale barley bread, and the outlaws had a goose that Angai had brought down on the ride, so supper that night was almost a feast. Arya was sucking the last bit of meat off a wing when one of the villagers turned to Lem Lemoncloak and said,
"There were men through here, not 2 days past, looking for the Kingslayer."
Lem snorted.
"They do better looking in Riverrun, down in the deepest dungeons, where it's nice and damp."
His nose looked like a squashed apple, red and raw and swollen, and his mood was foul.
"No," another villager said, "he's escaped." The Kingslayer.
Arya could feel the hair on the back of her neck prickling. She held her breath to listen.
"Could that be true?"
Tomo Seven said.
"I'll not believe it,"
said the one-eyed man in the rusty pothelm. The other outlaws called him Jack Bilucky, though losing an eye didn't seem very lucky to Arya.
"I've had me taste of them dungeons. How could he escape?"
The villagers could only shrug at that. Greenbeard stroked his thick grey and green whiskers and said,
"The wolves will drown in blood if the Kingslayer's loose again. Thoros must be told. The Lord of Late will show him Lannister in the flames."
"There's a fine fire burning here," said Angai, smiling.
Greenbeard laughed and cuffed the archer's ear.
"Do I look like a priest to you, archer? When Pillow of Tyrosh peers into the fire, the cinders singe his beard."
Lem cracked his knuckles and said,
"Wouldn't Lord Beric love to capture Jaime Lannister, though?" "Would he hang him then, Lem?"
one of the village women asked.
"It'll be half a shame to hang a man as pretty as that one."
"A trial first," said Angai. "Lord Beric always gives them a trial, you know that." He smiled. "Then he hangs them."
There was laughter all around. Then Tom drew his fingers across the strings of his woodharp and broke into soft song. The brothers of the Kingswood, they were an outlaw band. The forest was their castle, but they roamed across the land. No man's gold was safe from them, nor any maiden's hand. Oh, the brothers of the Kingswood, that fearsome outlaw band. Warm and dry in a corner, between Gendry and Harwin, Arya listened to the singing for a time, then closed her eyes and drifted off to sleep. She dreamt of home. Not Riverrun, but Winterfell. It was not a good dream, though. She was alone, outside the castle, up to her knees in mud. She could see the grey walls ahead of her, but when she tried to reach the gates, every step seemed harder than the one before, and the castle faded before her, until it looked more like smoke than granite. And there were wolves as well, gaunt grey shapes stalking through the trees all around her, their eyes shining. Whenever she looked at them, she remembered the taste of blood. The next morning they left the road to cut across the fields. The wind was gusting, sending dry brown leaves swirling around the hooves of their horses, but for once it did not rain. When the sun came out from behind a cloud, it was so bright Arya had to pull her hood forward to keep it out of her eyes. She reined up very suddenly.
"We are going the wrong way,"
Gendry groaned.
"What is it? Moss again?" "Look at the sun," she said. "We're going south."
Arya rummaged in her saddlebag for the map, so she could show them.
"We should never have left the Triton, see?"
She unrolled the map on her leg. All of them were looking at her now. "See, there's Riverrun between the rivers."
"As it happens," said Jack Belocchi. "We know where Riverrun is, every man of us."
"You're not going to Riverrun," Lem told her bluntly.
"I was almost there," Arya thought. "I should have let them take our horses. I could have walked the rest of the way." She remembered her dream then, and bit her lip.
"Ah, don't look so hurt, child," said Tom Sevenstrings. "No harm will come to you. You have my word on that."
"The word of a liar?"
"No one lied," said Lem. "We made no promises. It's not for us to say what's to be done with you."
Lem was not the leader, though, no more than Tom. That was Greenbeard, the Tyroshi. Arya turned to face him. "Take me to Riverrun, and you'll be rewarded," she said desperately.
"Little one," Greenbeard answered. "A peasant may skin a common squirrel for his pot, but if he finds a gold squirrel in his tree, he takes it to his lord, or he will wish he did."
"I'm not a squirrel," Arya insisted.
"Yeah," Greenbeard laughed. "A little gold squirrel who's off to see the Lightning Lord, whether she wills it or not. He'll know what's to be done with you. I'll wager he'll send you back to your lady mother just as you wish."
Tom Sevenstrings nodded.
"Aye, that's like Lord Beric. He'll do right by you. See if he don't."
Lord Beric Dondarrion. Arya remembered all she had heard at Harrenhal from the Lannisters and the Bloody Mamas alike. Lord Beric, the Wisp of the Wood, Lord Beric, who'd been killed by Varga Hote, and before that by Sir Aemery Lorch, and twice by the Mountain That Rides. "If he won't send me home, maybe I'll kill him too." "Why do I have to see Lord Beric?" she asked quietly.
"We bring him all our high-born captives," said Angai.
"Captive?" Arya took a breath to still her soul. "Calm as still water." She glanced at the outlaws on their horses and turned her horse's head.
"Now, quick as a snake," she thought, as she slammed her heels into the courser's flank.
Right between Greenbeard and Jack Belocchi she flew, and caught one glimpse of Gendry's startled face as his mount moved out of her way. And then she was in the open field and running. North or south, east or west, that made no matter now. She could find the way to Riverrun later, once she'd lost them. Arya leaned forward in the saddle and urged the horse to a gallop. Behind her, the outlaws were cursing and shouting at her to come back. She shut her ears to the calls, but when she glanced back over her shoulder, four of them were coming after her. And Guy and Harwin and Greenbeard racing side by side, with Lem farther back, his big yellow cloak flapping behind him as he rode. "Swift as a deer," she told her mount. "Run now, run!" Arya dashed across brown, weedy fields, through waist-high grass and piles of dry leaves that flurried and flew when her horse galloped past. There were woods to her left, she saw. "I can lose them there." A dry ditch ran along one side of the field, but she leapt it without breaking stride, and plunged in among the stand of elm and yew and birch trees. A quick peek back showed Angai and Harwin still hard on her heels. Greenbeard had fallen behind, though, and she could not see Lem at all. "Faster!" she told her horse. "You can! You can!" Between two elms she rode and never paused to see which side the moss was growing on. She leapt a rotten log and swung wide around a monstrous deadfall, jagged with broken branches. Then up a gentle slope and down the other side, slowing and speeding up again, her horse's shoes striking sparks off the flintstones underfoot. At the top of the hill she glanced back. Harwin had pushed ahead of Angai, but both were coming hard. Greenbeard had fallen further back and seemed to be flagging. A stream barred her way. She splashed down into it, through water choked with wet brown leaves. Some clung to a horse's legs as they climbed the other side. The undergrowth was thicker here, the ground so full of roots and rocks that she had to slow. But she kept as good a pace as she dared. Another hill before her, this one steeper. Up she went, and down again. How big are these woods, she wondered. She had the faster horse, she knew that. She had stolen one of Bruce Bolton's best from the stables at Harrenhal, but his speed was wasted here. I need to find the fields again. I need to find a road. Instead, she found a game trail. It was narrow and uneven, but it was something. She raced along it, branches whipping at her face. One snagged her hood and yanked it back, and for half a heartbeat she feared they had caught her. A vixen burst from the brush as she passed, startled by the fury of her flight. The game trail brought her to another stream. Or was it the same one? Had she gotten turned around? There was no time to puzzle it out. She could hear the horses crashing through the trees behind her. Thorns scratched at her face like the cats she used to chase in King's Landing. Sparrows exploded from the branches of an alder. But the trees were thinning now, and suddenly she was out of them. Broad, level fields stretched before her, all weeds and wild wheat, sudden and trampled. Arya kicked her horse back to a gallop. "Run!" she thought. "Run for River Run! Run for home!" Had she lost them? She took one quick look, and there was Harwin, 6 yards back and gaining. "No," she thought. "No, he can't. Not him. It isn't fair." Both horses were lathered and flagging by the time he came up beside her, reached over, and grabbed her bridle. Arya was breathing hard herself then. She knew the fight was done. "You ride like a Northman, milady," Harwin said when he'd drawn them to a halt. "Your aunt was the same, Lady Lyanna. But my father was master of horse, remember?" The look she gave him was full of hurt. "I thought you were my father's man. Lord Eddard's dead, milady. I belong to the Lightning Lord now, and to my brothers." "What brothers?" Old Hullan had fathered no other sons that Arya could remember. "Angai, Lem, Thomas Evans, Jack, and Greenbeard, all of them. We mean your brother Rob no ill, milady, but it's not him we fight for. He has an army all his own, and many a great lord to bend the knee. The small folk have only us." He gave her a searching look. "Can you understand what I'm telling you?" Yes, that he was not Rob's man, she understood well enough, and that she was his captive. "I could have stayed with Hot Pie. We could have taken the little boat and sailed it up to River Run." She had been better off as Squab. No one would take Squab captive. Or Nan, or Weasel, or Arry, the orphan boy. "I was a wolf," she thought. "But now I'm just some stupid little lady again." "Will you ride back peaceful now?" Harwin asked her.
or must I tie you up and throw you across your horse? All right, Peaceful, she said sullenly. For now. Samwell. Sobbing, Sam took another step.